Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick, and we are continuing on with our CISSP. And specifically in this episode, we're continuing our conversation on assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities in our system architecture. So we're just going to get right back into it. There's a lot of stuff we've got to talk about. And here is Mr. Adam Gordon.
Hello, everybody. I gave you the official Bullwinkle greeting before, but nobody responded. So
they're all doing it at home, I'm sure.
Happy Vulnerability Mitigation Day. All right, so let's jump back in and talk about what we're here to discuss. So we're going to continue on with the theme we've been going through in our prior episode, which is assessment of vulnerabilities, mitigation of them in systems architecture and security-related concerns, right? We've talked a lot about all the building blocks of systems in the prior episode. We're going to jump in and talk about some of the things that now run on top of those systems, right? So things like data, big data, how we manage data, cloud-based systems and cloud computing and things of that nature will be the focus of our general discussions here. So when we think about data, what we first have to do, and we've already talked about subject-object and the distinction between them, we're talking about object-related stuff, we talk about data, we have to think about what kind of data we're talking about. We know it's bits and bytes. We know data generically is that, at least in a computer anyway. But it could take lots of different capabilities, lots of different data classifications, lots of different concerns to help understand and articulate what data is, and as a result of that, figure out how to manage it effectively. We talked a lot about the importance of classification of data. Is data going to have a certain level of protection associated with it? If the answer is yes, we need to understand the meaning of the data and the impact of the data to the organization. So where do we store data? Let's start with that. We typically put it, obviously, clearly in storage devices, whether it is short-term in memory, long-term on a hard drive, out on a storage array, wherever it is. If we have a large volume of data, we often talk about putting that into a data warehouse. A data warehouse is simply just a very large database that is constructed in such a way that we can use special tools to be able to interact with and manage the data. When we're talking about petabytes or terabytes of data, we're talking about probably putting it into a data warehouse. When we're talking about megabytes or gigabytes of data, we're most likely talking about storing it locally. And so the idea of using a data warehouse is one way that we can assess vulnerabilities and then come up with a mitigation strategy to manage data more effectively, because by warehousing, putting large volumes of data into a central system that can be access controlled, can be continuously monitored, can be risk assessed, can be audited, can be managed so that people can interact with it, but we can understand and log and create traceability and create visibility and therefore accountability around those interactions is a good thing. And so using data warehousing is going to be a mechanism that we should be thinking about, because it lets us combine data that may be stored locally in different areas in the system that is harder to manage, harder to keep track of in one location. Centralizing data storage and data usage also centralizes data security, and it makes it easier to keep track of things. So data warehousing may be a good thing for us to think about. The idea behind managing data is fairly straightforward, right? Put the data in one place, apply access controls to it, figure out who's coming and going, what they're doing, and only show them the data that they're supposed to see. That part's pretty straightforward. But what if we show you the data you're supposed to see, but as a result of doing that, you may actually be able to figure out there's other data in the system, but we're not showing it to you? You'd be a pretty smart person if you could do that. Mike was actually practicing this technique while we were off camera, and he was doing something known as inference. And what inference is the ability to be able to deduce, to effectively infer, that there is information available in the system that may be hidden, that we're not seeing, from other information that we are seeing. So, for instance, if I was to give you three pieces of information, and I was to say to you, my first name is Adam, right? I like colorful socks, as you all well know. And as a result of being named Adam and liking colorful socks, I'm going to be presenting to you today and talking about CISSP-related information. You could probably deduce or infer several things from those three pieces of information. You could deduce that I'm a very sharp and snazzy dresser who has a sense of fashion because I wear colorful socks. You could deduce that I probably know something about CISSP and CISSP-related information because I've been asked to present that to you here today. You may also deduce the fact that Mike may have developed laryngitis because he's not able to speak, and so I have to speak on his behalf. Any or all of those things may be possible for you to infer or deduce from at least two of the three pieces of information that I've shared with you. I never came right out and told you any of those things. I simply gave you basic information, but you were able to potentially infer or understand that there may have been other things that were there, but just not said. And this is the idea behind inference. The idea is that if we show you information during the normal course of data management, we show you a spreadsheet with sales figures in it, but there are other columns in the spreadsheet that are hidden, you may be able to deduce information about the value of information in those columns if we're not very careful about how we present the available information to you that you're supposed to see. And the ways in which we do that have to really be understood, have to be monitored, have to be managed, have to be vetted, or we may inadvertently, by accident, expose information through inference that actually is supposed to be kept secret. So this is something we have to really think about and be aware of, because this poses a potential vulnerability and a threat, potentially, to information security, to confidentiality, and, of course, to integrity. And this is something we have to think about and obviously understand. So something to be concerned about. Aggregation is also something we have to think about with regards to data and the management of data. Combining non-sensitive data from separate sources together to create sensitive data is what aggregation is all about. We could take out sensitive, non-sensitive, and simply say combining data from different sources together to understand additional data, create additional data, is aggregation. We're building a whole from different parts. And effectively by doing that, we are stitching together and creating a picture of something that under normal circumstances, we may not be able to see. So I may be able to take data from several different systems and aggregate it together to create a picture of data that doesn't normally exist in any one system. Business intelligence and specifically big data analytical tools, data visualization tools, help us to do aggregation. They are good and they are valuable and they are meaningful for us to use in systems. But if used incorrectly by the wrong people with the wrong level of access, they can lead to aggregation. And as a result of aggregation, they can lead to the breach of confidentiality and the modification of data without our knowledge, the impact of integrity. They could also lead to lack of availability because people may then be able to deduce that they should go and attack a system to gain access to resources and through denial of service or something of that nature, potentially render the data unavailable to us when we need it. So in effect, all three pillars of information security can be affected through aggregation. This is something to keep in mind. We also want to think about data mining. Data mining is the ability to be able to go out and discover information, but specifically targeted at data warehouses. We started the conversation by talking about what a data warehouse is. Think of Costco, but for data, right? That's a big data warehouse. You know, lots and lots of stuff on a lot of shelves. You buy in bulk, right? Bulk information is there in multiple formats. If we go and mine through that information using tools that will extract value through aggregation and inference, we could begin to see that we may run into complications here. If we have all the data sitting in one place, it's easy to protect it, but it's hard potentially to know the value of what's there because we may not really understand all the data. There's so much of it, we just not maybe really understand everything that's going on with it. And so as a result of that, if somebody is able to get a tool connected to the data warehouse that can do aggregation and perform inference-related activities, they may be able to do data mining. And when they do data mining, they may be able to find hidden value in the data that we're unaware of and be able to gain access to it without our knowledge. And this obviously can lead to compromises, as we've discussed as well. So data mining can also be a potential issue here. I want to think about large-scale parallel data systems, these huge, massive online systems that allow us to look at incredible volumes of data, either through grid computing or just parallel processing. These are very large, very high-end, very complex systems that bring tremendous computing power together in one or more locations scattered throughout, let's say, geographically distributed architectures that are brought together to then effectively create processing power at the point of contact. You could think of something like the SETI program, if you're familiar with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The SETI program effectively creates a parallel data structure, a parallel data processing system, a grid system, by asking you to download a little piece of software, a little applet, a little application you can run. So does the Human Genome Project. They both effectively work the same way, where you download a little application, and then what it does is it connects up to a mainframe system that is geographically going to grab processing power from all of these different local computers that are running the software and use that processing capability on down cycles on your system to effectively coordinate processing of these incredibly complicated computer program runs that have to be done to map out the, you know, space map to look for intelligence, to process all the background noise, or to map the human genome or sequence DNA or things of that nature. So distributed computing architectures are what we're talking about. These also present some interesting challenges for us, but also interesting capabilities. How do we know how to secure data that is being processed from 1,000 different distributed or non-centralized endpoints around the globe. It's very, very difficult to figure out how to do that, and it's even more difficult to do it successfully. So these are also systems that we have to think about and be aware of as well. Something else for us to consider, obviously, right? And so, you know, the challenges in these distributed architectures are really trust. How do we trust all the endpoints? How do we know what's there? How do we ensure privacy? How do we know that data is being kept secure in all of these systems? How do we apply general security thought processes to this distributed architecture? How do we know that each endpoint is secured and that the software that's been downloaded and running on it has not been compromised? You know, these are things we have to think about, and obviously, as a security professional, would have to keep in mind and be aware of as well. So I want to think about these things. The ultimate thought process that this leads up to is the idea of talking about cloud computing a little bit, of what cloud computing is. You know, it is a distributed architecture, obviously. We're going to be able to access it from multiple places and use it from multiple locations. So let's start with a specific definition. What I'm going to do is cite the definition for cloud computing that comes to us from the NIST document, the definition document NIST put out around the definition of cloud computing. This is the standard definition that everybody is going to agree on for cloud computing. You may hear different interpretations of cloud computing, but ultimately the one definition everybody agrees on is the definition I'm about to read to you. I don't normally read many things to you, and I almost never read to you while we are having our conversations during any one of our episodes. We're always talking, we're joking around, but we're not reading to you, right? So this is one of the only times you're going to see me stare down at my screen and read to you for a minute, but I want to give you the exact definition so that you understand exactly what it is and the importance of why it needs to be framed a certain way. So please start paying attention and please listen. Put on my reading voice. I need a smoking jacket and a pipe. All right, so a model for enabling ubiquitous, convenient, on-demand network access to a shared pool of configurable computing resources that can be rapidly provisioned and released with minimal management effort or service provider interaction. This cloud model is composed of five essential characteristics, three service models, and four deployment models. Now, the good news is that you can rewind that definition and listen to it as often as you would like. It's almost like a book on tape, right? But in addition, you can also go and look it up. We're not going to show you the NIST document, but I've mentioned several times, and we've shown you several times, where the NIST website is. If you want to go look for that definition, just go out to the NIST website and search for cloud computing, and you will find the definition document there. It's about 12 or 15 pages, so it's very small, but it's going to list that definition. It's also going to go through and list for you the five essential characteristics of cloud computing. We just talked about it. We're going to put these up on the screen for you in just a minute. It's also going to list for you the three cloud service models, and it's also going to list for you the four cloud deployment models that we can use in terms of architecture. We're going to throw these up on the screen for you right now and talk through them so you can see them, take some notes on them, but we want to make sure you're familiar with all of this information, because all of these are the definitional components, the building blocks that you need to be aware of in order to talk knowledgeably about cloud computing. So all of this is in the NIST document, just to make that clear and to remind you of that. Five essential characteristics of cloud computing. We listed them in the definition. You'll see them on the screen in front of you. On-demand self-service. The ability to be able to go out and through a common interface, be able to interact with and consume the cloud service on demand, when you need it, in other words, is one of the defining essential characteristics. Broad network access. You can get to the cloud from almost anywhere. It is available everywhere, broadly. Resource pooling. We share resources and pool them together to form the cloud-based environments that we use. Compute resources, storage resources, network resources. These are the resources of cloud computing. Rapid elasticity, the ability to be able to scale up quickly. People often forget this. Scaling down is also part of rapid elasticity. So we can blow up quickly and do what's called effectively scaling up to be able to give you additional resources, right? We would also be able to scale down during periods of low usage. So we can scale up and scale down under rapid elasticity. We also can scale out, meaning we can grow. The architecture is able to not just scale up and scale down, but also scale out as necessary rapidly and quickly because of resource pooling to accommodate additional needs and additional users. Measured services. We use metrics to be able to understand what you're consuming. And effectively, the model for cloud is more often than not, you pay as you go. You pay for what you use, in other words. So it is a consumption model that is measured and is using, or we are using metrics in order to be able to figure out how to manage ultimately over time. These are the five essential characteristics of cloud computing. Let's take a look at the three cloud service models. They are up on the screen in front of you. You probably are familiar with one or more of them. I'm sure you've heard of many different things as a service. We have all sorts of things today as a service. But the three that are established as definitional criteria, the three as a service models, SaaS or software, PaaS, platform, IaaS or infrastructure as a service, are the three original ones that everybody agrees on. And again, I'm not suggesting for a minute that there aren't other as-a-service areas, other as-a-service models that are important. You may very well be consuming one or more of them. You're actually consuming, if you think about it, learning as a service, which is a new thought process in the cloud-enabled world of remote and distance learning. But as you're engaging through IT Pro TV and using our services to be able to learn in interactive environments, you're effectively consuming learning as a service. There are many different service models, but the three that are accepted, that everybody agrees on, that the definitions are standardized for, are the three we're going to focus on and talk about. Those are the three you should be familiar with regards to the CISSP exam. So please be aware of that. SaaS, software as a service. This is the ability. Actually, you know what? Let's do this the other way. Let's start with IaaS. And the reason I'm going to say that is that what we want to do is walk up the stack, finishing with SaaS, because SaaS actually will incorporate all three. So we'll start with IaaS, infrastructure as a service. Bad presenter. I should have thought of that and done that the other way. So infrastructure as a service. This is where you as a customer are going to be able to go to the cloud provider, the Googles, the Amazons, the Microsofts of the world, and you're going to be able to rent effectively for a monthly fee the core infrastructure components that allow you to run a network. You're going to rent effectively one or more computers. You're going to rent the computer itself made up of the CPU, the memory, the networking, and the storage components, the four resource groups we provision cloud around, and you're going to rent that from the cloud service provider. You're going to rent as many as you want. And they're going to give you that infrastructure, and they're then going to say to you, Mr. Customer, here's everything you wanted. Now you're going to load your own operating system on it, so you have to pay for software licensing. You're going to load your own data on it. You have to configure and manage that system accordingly, and you're then going to be responsible for the upkeep and management of that system. IaaS is really just that. It's just infrastructure. It's computing infrastructure, nothing more, as a service for a monthly fee. When we move up to PaaS, platform as a service, we are renting the infrastructure below the platform. So the infrastructure provider, the cloud service provider, is giving us all the stuff we just discussed, but they're also loading the operating system for us. So they're taking care of software licensing. We don't have to worry about that. In addition, they are going to configure the system. They're going to set it all up. They're going to build it. They're going to image it, whatever they have to do. They're going to take care of all of that. All we need to do is, once it's configured and they hand it to us, log in, obviously, right? So we get our log on. We log on. The OS is already there. Now what we do, the customer, we load our applications and our data and our development environments, and then we manage them on top of the platform. So the provider is giving us the full platform, infrastructure and operational system, or OS. We are then loading everything else up and managing that. So that's the break point there with PaaS. PaaS is traditionally seen as a dev environment or an application hosting environment on demand. That's usually what it's used for. Companies that want to do application development, that want to host their own databases, run their own application services, will use a PaaS model. That's traditionally what they use. SaaS, software as a service, incorporates infrastructure as well as platform. And what you get there is the ability to basically rent all of that, including vendor-based software, whatever that may be, for a fee monthly. So think about Office 365. Think about Salesforce.com. These are software as a service models. Specifically, within software as a service, we have two distinct software models. We have hosted application management. So we have an Office 365 model where you can pay the provider to host, or Salesforce.com, where you can pay the provider to host your data, and they give you access to an application. Microsoft Exchange for email, Microsoft SharePoint for enterprise content management, Salesforce.com for CRM. That's a hosted application model where they host the entire application and all the infrastructure and platform support that goes with it. They do all the updates to the application. They do the patch management. They do the database maintenance. They do the access control. They'll provide the back end for that. You will provision users, but they provide the actual enforcement mechanisms on the back end. They do all the logging. They do all the transactional monitoring. They do all the configuration management. They build the whole thing. All you do is put your data there and consume. In the other kind of SaaS model, you're renting just individual application software. This is the Office 365 model, but specifically the Office portion of it, where you download Microsoft Office and install it on demand. We call it on-demand software. And you install Microsoft Office from the cloud, and you then run Office on your local machine for a monthly fee. That's the other kind of SaaS model that we have. So software as a service effectively means you're renting the software and you're providing access to the software in that model. As a result of having those three software models, we still now have to talk about the three cloud service models. We have one more list we need to go to. We have to talk about the cloud deployment models, and we're going to put those up on the screen. And the cloud deployment models allow us to shape and discuss what type of cloud we're going to use. We have four models. Now, you may be familiar with the first three. You may have heard of them. You probably haven't heard of the fourth one as much. Community cloud is not one that a lot of people know about or talk about. So let's talk about all of them. The private cloud is going to be the ability to run a cloud internal to your network, really just for your team members, your employees. Nobody else from the outside can get into it. You typically will either host it on-prem inside your company. You may pay somebody to host it for you. Microsoft, Google, Amazon can host private clouds for you as well. You will provision and manage that. That is what we would have thought of years ago as an intranet, an internal private network, is effectively now rebranded as a private cloud. I want to get the gig where I sit in a room, I come up with new innovative marketing slogans, right? And I remake everybody's world, but I still call it this, just it's something new, but it's still the same thing. The
same thing.
Right? Yeah. That's what I want to do when I grow up, right? So if anybody has that job out there, somebody email me, let me know. I want to come work for you if I can do that. All right, so the public cloud, right? Public cloud, the biggest example we have of a public cloud in the world is the internet or the World Wide Web. And we've had that for many years. And again, we used to call public clouds the internet or the World Wide Web because that's what they were. Today, we call it a public cloud. It is simply a cloud that is available to people, to individuals, right? And they can get into it. Some of them may have to log in. They may have to authenticate. Some may not. Some of them may just be open to everybody regardless. So think about, for instance, going to Amazon.com, going to CNN, going to IT Pro TV, right? Whatever it is. All of that's available through a public cloud. You get to it through the internet, through the World Wide Web. You access one or more websites. The majority of that material is available to you without you logging in. You can go to the ITPro.tv website without being a member and look at demos of the shows and things like that, right? So you can see all that without having to be a member. But then you may have to log in and go to the private side of that environment, log into an environment where we only have contents available to members, and then that may cross over into the private side of the cloud. And so public and private clouds can commingle. And that's often where we see what's known as a hybrid cloud. A hybrid cloud is going to combine the two together, or combine two of the three cloud models together, because it could be private, public, and or community that are joined together in a hybrid. But the idea is a hybrid simply means we join two of the three models together, and we give access to both, in theory, through one sort of common model. The community cloud, ultimately, last cloud model we talk about, it's kind of interesting. People often think of it as just being a private cloud. In effect, it is in one respect. It is a subset of the private cloud. But the way I often talk about community cloud is the following. Private clouds are going to be only available to everybody in the organization. So broadly available, but only to the people in the organization. So if you have a, let's say, a business where you have 1,000 team members, 1,000 employees, a private cloud would be available to all 1,000 at the same time. So services like email would be available through the private cloud to everybody in the organization. Enterprise content management, so file and print sharing, would be available through a private cloud to everybody in the organization at the same time. A community cloud is a cloud that is generated by a subgroup, a group that has specific interests that they want to deal with and provide services around within the cloud, but they only want it to be open to members of that group. So it's like a subset of the private cloud. So in some organizations, we often see that we have private cloud services, like I mentioned, email, file and print sharing, things like that, available to everybody. And then a group like sales and marketing may go off on their own and create a community cloud that is unique to their needs because, you know, things like social media services, things like data analytics, things of that nature may be unique to that particular group, and they want to be able to have a community cloud that's specifically tailored for them to offer those services only to the members of that group. And that's what a community cloud really does. It offers a limited focus, a group of people that share common concerns, partake of the community cloud, and then those people can exist and interact within that cloud, right? So this is how the definition is ultimately going to play out, if you will.
All right, very good, Adam. Again, a lot of information, and I believe we're still not done with looking at vulnerabilities, assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities in our security architecture, but we're going to save that for another one. So we're going to have a part three for this episode, so make sure you come back for that one. Remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email at cadam@itpro.tv. For now, signing off, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm not.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.